I've been thinking a great deal about death this week, how we die. Because one of my friends suddenly discovered that he's dying. And so for everybody in his world, it's alarming, extremely alarming. How could this happen? This vital, completely engaged, wonderful person who's right at the top of his life and his ability suddenly be struck down in this way. And he's really struck down. If you've seen Steve Stuckey's website where they have the talk that he gave to Green Gulch before he couldn't give a talk anymore, it's, you can hear it. He's just barely holding on.
I listened to it last night.
Did you? Yeah. It's very touching. Mm-hmm. Very, very touching. He's just taking it like a man, you could say, you know, or like a gentleman, with deep insight into this is how things are for us, but also with the grief and the sorrow that comes with it for everybody around, including oneself, how much we have to give up, how much we have to lose, and how hard it is to let go of all that we love and all that we're attached to. So really the subject of death comes around again to the subject of self and attachment. and of course the more attached we are to ourself, the more we resist the whole idea of death. And often, even at the very end, can't let go. Though usually I've heard from my friends who work in hospitals, Catherine
Stark,
thanks, does wonderful work being with people in their very last moments. And she said often they come in resisting and at the end have gotten soft in their mind, soft and gentle in their mind, and just dropped off all the resentments and the jealousies and the angers and all the things that stick to us like burrs, and just allow what's happening to happen. I've seen that happen myself, when it's just a quiet allowing of this to be happening because this is what is happening. And it doesn't have any meaning beyond just what's happening right now in this moment. We think we leave life and go to death, but actually we leave life and then deaths. And it's not a step so much as a backward step, you could say. It's not a forward step into something. It's what Emily Dickinson's stone says in the graveyard, gone back. Mm-hmm. It's going back where we came from. And so in a way, it's not a horrific thing at all. It's a very peaceful thing. We don't know where we came from, really. We somehow miraculously coalesced into this human being inside of another human being. So mysteriously, just that whole process is so unbelievable. And as we step back, we don't know where we're going. And of course, there are many, many stories made up about this, about where we're going. We're going to heaven, we're going to hell, we're going to purgatory, where we just linger forever. There are lots and lots of stories about it because we really want to know. We'd give anything to know. And even though the Tibetans are positive, and my brothers, Christian brothers, are positive that they know where we're going, they don't even agree. So it seems like we can't say. We just can't say. But one thing that we can say is that at some point, and it will usually be a big surprise, we'll be out of here. We'll have to go. And so if we're able to face this and acknowledge it, it makes the flavor of our life so very different. It's a scientific fact that I have to die. But it seems like there's something in that that turns my whole life around in a way that makes it very mysterious. The one funeral I saw Coben do was a very tragic one where someone's daughter burned up in a fire. And we gathered around the coffin at the gravesite itself, and Coben rapped on the coffin and he said, "Tathagata, we don't know where you come from and we don't know where you go." And then he shouted, it was outside, and he shouted, "Tathagata," just blasting it, calling in the Buddha, sending out the Buddha, bringing it all into a focus of Buddha, Tathagata. Coming and going, coming and going. And though he said when we chant the Heart Sutra, it's often chanted at a funeral, always chanted, sometimes over and over and over again as people offer incense, that it's a happy thing. Because what it's saying is that form, this form, these eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, is no different from the whole of it. The whole thing. So within the whole thing, forms come and go. We are coming and going. In truth, we're dying every day, but when we actually die and go into a coffin, we've gone. But for the fact that we've left ourselves behind in everybody else's mind. And so, although that's cold comfort, I think, for people when they've lost a dear one, the truth is that's how best we know and love people anyway, is how we know them, our own deep knowledge of the people that we love. It isn't their body so much, because the body keeps changing. You know, I looked at a picture of the man I married the other day. Really cool-looking guy. He was something. And that gray, fat, blubbery guy that passed away a few years ago is very different from the one I married 50 years ago. But in my heart, all of him I still carry. He's still with me and always will be. I dream of him all the time. So in that mysterious way, nothing is lost as long as we're here with our memories. And that each memory that we carry of someone else affects how we are, who we are. And that affects who we know. And so our life and our memories then become transformed into other people's minds. And so you can feel the one-mindedness of even this coming and going of life and death. Not in some magical way. It isn't magic at all. It's just how we are. We take each other in. And we lose each other. It's the hardest part of marriage, is that you know that one of you is going to lose the other one. And although in the beginning years of marriage it doesn't seem possible at all, it's just a ridiculous idea. But even in young marriages it happens. Boom. I know several people who came to Zazen because they suddenly confronted an instant, unexpected death in the mountains, where they were hiking along with their beloved, and suddenly the beloved wasn't there. Looked down 600 feet and see them on a ledge, gone. And my friend Maria went around for days and days just totally bewildered how this could happen. One moment she was here, the next moment she was over the cliff and gone. It's inconceivable, really. And yet it is. And so she came to sitting because she couldn't figure anything else to do with her, not only her grief, but her puzzlement. What to do with this mysterious thing that happened? And it's not that Zazen gives an answer. Zazen doesn't tell us where we're going or what it'll be like. But Zazen gives us a much, much bigger field of mind in which to experience what we experience. A much bigger embrace of what happens. We have two kinds of mind, the kind that can really focus in. I always think with tiny screwdrivers and little screws, and we can do everything and make it all work. But if we just focus on this kind of mind, figuring it all out, we lose the sense of the largeness of it all. That's so large that it includes everything, even our death. So one of my favorite stories is a old Tibetan Lama lying in his deathbed, and his students are all standing around sobbing, and he said, "Oh, you fools, don't you know that nothing happens?" I find that quite consoling. Because the life is happening as long as it's life, and then death is a different happening. So nothing is happening as long as you're alive, except just being alive. But if we're not aware of the wholeness of this lump of flesh, of what its fate is, our life is a misunderstanding. If we're too focused, we leave out everybody else, mostly, because that's the way our mind works. It's always separating, I like this and I don't like that, I want this, I don't want that. And so whatever we're liking and wanting or don't wanting and liking is all happening in our mind. It's all our own attitude It's not about the other. And it's only when we open the widest of us, which is our heart and our belly, where everything lives in us, where we take everything in, that we are fulfilling this human nature of us. That we're able to reach out as well as take in. And to accept rather than reject. And to be willing to not know in the midst of the mystery of what we do know. We'll never know enough. And so, knowing that we're dying from the moment we're born, dying, gives us a kind of humility. And anything else is hubris. Anything else is just putting on a show. It's interesting to think of people that we're afraid of, or we too highly respect. The way we used to do as children was to think of the Queen of England sitting on the toilet. Ha, 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 the Queen of England even takes a pee. No, and it just shatters that whole concept of high and low. And it's true of thinking of death in that way. Everyone we see, everyone we know, is fated to die. So however good or bad they are, however sweet or sour they are, they're on their way just like we are. So we belong to each other in this journey. And there are marvelous studies being done about the mind and the body and how the body works and how the mind works. And there are huge arguments going on now that are very fertile, very useful and interesting about how it's connected up, all of it, and what it means. But we don't know. So that's what I brought. Wendy?
Regarding your talk, would you repeat your idea about life? For some people, life is a misunderstanding. Do you remember?
Yes, yes.
That's because they're not aware of the precious gift of their life?
I think it's not having experienced or allowed and cultivate the experience of the other side, the wider mind as well as the narrow mind, or the small mind.
Well, that includes a lot of people.
Yes. Yes. And there are a lot of people who cultivate big mind, you could say, by going fishing and not caring whether they catch a fish, but just wanting a quiet place to go and be for a long time. I think a lot of people live their lives like that. in touch but not having a way of formalizing a practice, but just kind of catch as catch can.
Yes, but you know, I worked 12 years in an assisted living facility, so I would observe people in different stages of facing death. And I saw a lot of people that wanted to die. They wanted me to shoot them or something.
Yes.
You know, it's like their mind had already died.
Mm-hmm.
Their body was just going.
Yeah.
And my parents lived to a very ripe age, and I know my mom would think she was definitely ready to die. But that body has its own will to live.
Mm-hmm.
And to step back from that's very hard. Of course, they have drugs that help you do that. But, I don't know if some of these Zen teachers would do that. I know Suzuki Roshi didn't take any pain medications when he was dying.
Well, Steve said in his talk that he was grateful for them.
Okay.
He said he wouldn't be there without them.
Okay.
So, I think Suzuki Roshi was extraordinary to be able to do that. I think there are lots of different ways. I have a friend who was so terrified to meet her parents in heaven. She never said what it was that she was afraid of, but she was afraid to meet them and have to be with them again. And she hung on way past when she should have died. So, and I know a woman who sat Zazen for years and years preparing to die. And she said, oh, I've got it together. I'm ready. Whenever it comes, I'm ready. And then she was struck with cancer and she was terrified. Just terrified. So you really don't know of
the suffering
and the not knowing. Where am I going? Maybe it's some bad place. You know, there's always all these stories we can make up about it because we don't know.
I've never heard that expressed.
Well, that was a Zen person, so... So we make up different stories. So.
Well, I know my mother didn't believe in afterlife, but I didn't see that she was. I think she was had her main apprehension was about suffering.
Mm-hmm. I think for many people, maybe most people, that's the thing, and rightly so. It's like birth. Birth is extremely traumatic. It's very, very painful and difficult. You think what the baby has to go through is just awful. There's a wonderful book out now about birth. And with great drawings of the pelvis and all the different ways that you can see how the bones have their own life. And at a certain point, the bones start to squeeze. And how they even know what to do, nobody knows at this point. And the kid just gets squished, his head gets squished, and everything gets pressed. And it's awful. So, I think death is like that. It's like another birth. And then once it's over, there's this wonderful And you see this beautiful face. Beautiful, quiet, peaceful face. It's over. Last breath. No more in.
Do you think what the mother goes through during birth is kind of matched by the child?
Yes.
Because when you have that...
Yes.
I mean, I could just feel David coming out. Yeah.
Oh, finally.
Finally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the baby takes a big breath in.
Yeah.
And starts to cry. Yeah.
So, is Steve living at Green Gulch now?
No, I think he's living half and half in City Center and Sonoma with his wife and his Sangha up there.
Oh, okay.
He has a sitting group up there, and I think another one still in San Rafael. But he's a householder.
Okay,
he's an abbot, wears brown robes, and lives a whole abbot's life with a secretary and a jisha and the whole kit and caboodle. But he's also a householder and plays the cello and is a good musician, a very good musician.
Likes to sing the blues.
Yeah, he loves the blues.
Wonderful.
That was
Lightning Hopkins.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So
don't want to see my children crying. Yeah. Yeah, he's a great guy with great sense of humor. Also very quiet and kind of shy.
And I think he was one of the firefighters that saved Sahara.
Yes. Yes, very brave. Very, very brave.
I like when he quoted Dogen about our mind being the whole earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our body knows our body.
Our body.
Our body is the whole earth.
But that includes the whole mind, so.
Yes.
Yeah. It is. And you see it as you drive along. You see these great heaps of earth that just seem like you could hold it and embrace it as a body.
Yeah, I was driving to the Zendo the other night, and it was, I guess, about 6:15, 6:20, and there were kind of clouds or some kind of mist in the western sky. But not so much that you couldn't see the sun. And so the sun was this beautiful orb. It looked just like a ball. Because you didn't have all that glare all around it. And then right over my head, maybe 200 blackbirds flew this way and that way. It was incredible. It was like, oh, I'm going to get in an accident. Because it was like so enchanting to see this. And it was almost like everything else disappeared. And I think I wanted everything else to disappear and just
be there. Yeah.
That's very special.
Yeah, those are wake-up times.
Yeah.
And my Tibetan friend Tim Lee says that those times you dedicate those experiences to Buddha. We walked by a beautiful rhododendron bush one time in Berkeley, this huge one, full bloom, and she, oh, I dedicate this beautiful bush to Buddha. Oh, that's really nice.
Bruce Hawthorne, Hawthorne tree. hawthorn bushes?
No, it was a rhododendron.
No, I know, but I'm reminded me of Proust.
Oh, Proust. Oh, yes.
Hawthorn.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Like
yes, mm-hmm. Only even more so.
Right.
The hawthorns even more. Anything else? Well, maybe we should sit.